Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. I've taken a brief sabbatical from interviewing for the last couple of months, but I'm happy to say I'm back, and I'm back with a terrific book. It is Francis Spufford's Red Plenty, Industry, Progress, Abundance, Inside the 50s Soviet Dream. It's a bit of a departure for us in the sense that it is historical fiction, though, of course, it is based on true events. More importantly, it's an interesting example of what happens when the empirical restraints, which are generally placed on historians, are somewhat relaxed. Francis tells us what happened, what actually happened, but he does so through a series of fictionalized characters and situations. And he does it masterfully. If I had to recommend one book about the Soviet Union to someone who wanted to understand it, I think I would recommend Red Plenty rather than a traditional history. You might find that surprising. In any event, I absolutely guarantee you that if you read Red Plenty, if you're interested in the Soviet Union or not, you will be very gratified. And I was very pleased to talk to Francis today. And I hope that you enjoy the interview. So without further delay, here it is. Hi, Francis.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm pretty well.
I'm glad to hear that. Today we have Francis Spufford on the show, and we're going to be talking about his terrific book, Red Plenty. I was a bit skeptical of this book when I got it in the mail. I got it unsolicited. I get a lot of books, and I don't read a lot of what, we'll talk about this, I call it historical fiction. Other people call it other things. I don't read a lot of it, but it was about the Soviet Union, and I studied the Soviet Union, or did, and so I thought, who in the heck would write a book about the Soviet Union, a work of historical fiction about the Soviet Union? And so I started to read it, and I honestly got very enthusiastic about the book. I think Francis will tell you. It was like I was a stalker or something, because I just emailed him out of the blue, and I'm like, you've written a great book. You know, you've written a great book. What can I do? What can I do? And, you know, I did everything I possibly could to make sure that the book reached the widest possible audience. And I think it has reached a wide audience, though. I'm very happy to say that, too, because it is a really, really terrific book. If you want to understand the Soviet Union, do not read my books. Read Francis's book. It's a lot better. And as he says in the introduction, there's more truth in it, even though it is a kind of historical fiction. Again, we'll talk about whether he thinks it's historical fiction or not. But Francis, welcome to the show. Could you begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Right. I'm a British writer. My background is as a literature person. But I come from a family of historians. Father, medieval economic; mother, 17th century social. So scholarship is kind of in the environment and possibly in the DNA, although not actually in what I do for a living. I know what scholarship looks like, and I know that what I do isn't quite it, though I try not to offend against it too gravely. The things I write have no common thread whatever, except that I was interested in them at the time, and I thought that they were interestingly difficult to write about. So I've got a book about cultural history of British polar exploration, book about children's literature, which is a kind of memoir, book about engineering and 20th century British history, and Red Plenty, which is about the Soviet economy under Khrushchev.
Yeah. I was going to say, you are one of those people that took all that liberal arts crap seriously.
Why wouldn't you act on the permission to wander around?
Yeah, no, it's true. I did too. And I, if you look at the books, I mean, I wrote a lot of things on Russian history, but I just had a book about the history of communications, and I write for magazines about stuff that has nothing to do with anything. And as we discussed before, I've become a tradesman. I don't know why I've done that, but it seemed interesting to me, and so I did it, you know, and I'm not starving yet, and neither are my children, although that may be coming. I don't know. I might have to put the bite on you for dollars.
You're far away on a different continent.
That's right.
Your powers to put the bite on me are strictly limited.
It's very limited. You're absolutely right. So you do wander around a little bit, and I think that's a good thing. I often describe myself as a professional dilettante. I won't paint you with that brush. How did you come to write Red Plenty? It is, not to put too fine a point on it, not something everyone knows about this period in the 1950s in the Soviet Union.
What I hope is that I haven't done it from a pure spirit of perversity, because there is a little bit of me that likes the idea of arm wrestling against the most boring possible subject that one could find. And forcing it into a state of submission in which it has to yield up something interesting. But that, I'm glad to say, is not my only motive here. I started off interested in Plenty without the red. The germ of the book came along during the dot-com bubble, when I found myself very interested in the psychology of abundance and people's perennial desire to believe that this time it would be feast, 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 and never fast again. But the dot-com bubble, though it did have British, you know, it had a British version, it wasn't that local to me. So I didn't end up pursuing the kind of technological aspect of it. And I found myself thinking, well, this is actually one of a family of similar 20th century situations. And I thought, after I'd looked at it for a bit, that actually it would be interestingly kind of dissonant and world rearranging to look at the 20th century Soviet quest for plenty, not as it's usually seen, as a kind of diametrical opposite to the story of 20th century capitalism, but as a kind of cousin to it, something the weird, mutant, bloody-handed cousin, but still recognisable as a cousin, part of a general 20th century attempt to get us out of ancestral scarcity into the state of abundance. That then required me to start knowing things about Russia. And as ought to be really very clear from the description of my books, I'm not a Russianist. I don't have a background in Soviet history. I don't, in fact, speak Russian or read Russian. So I was dependent on interpreters when I was there and people kindly translating stuff for me when I was doing the research. And God bless it, the Central Intelligence Agency, which invested so much money
they
in
did.
The 50s and 60s, translating Soviet materials so that 40 years later, I could be the first person in a research library to consult them.
They did a nice job.
Yeah, thank you. thank you. And there was a certain thrill in picking up RAND Corporation reports called Major Personalities in Soviet Cybernetics and realizing that you were the first to open its dusty pages since 1971. Hey, I like that kind of thing.
Major Personalities in Soviet Cybernetics. Yeah, note that, you know.
But once upon a time, no, this is why once upon a time that word major was not ironic. Once upon a time, I can't remember who it was in Kennedy's kitchen cabinet. It could even have been Arthur Schlesinger or somebody like that was announcing nervously that Soviet cybernetics was their ace in the hole, and that unless the West closed the cybernetic gap, we were going to be stuffed, screwed, unable to compete with the sleek, modern efficiency of the Soviet economy. And it's getting back to the point where that seemed like a reasonable perspective that was one of the major goals of the book. It seems to me that although the Soviet economy turns out to be a famous disaster, and you can see the kind of the lineage of the disaster already growing if you look hard in 1960, it needs still to be rescued from the patronage of history and from a kind of rather lazy teleological idea that you can read disaster back into it all the way. It seems to me that we are failing to understand the past properly if we don't attempt to understand it on its own terms. And the middle of the 20th century is surprisingly far away in its assumptions about what is rational, what is to be for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things I liked about the book is that it deals with one of the several attempts on the part of the Bolshevik Party to make the Soviet economy work. One of the things that I don't know whether it was Richard Pipes or Martin Maley or somebody pointed out was that no one had ever built the socialist economy before. They didn't know how to do it. I mean, the idea of planning is pretty simple. You create a budget and you distribute resources, and then you try to optimize the use of those resources, and you meet demand and take some sort of census of people to see what they want. And it's all quite rational. It might be how your household runs, I don't know. But actually doing it on a very large scale is extraordinarily difficult. And they were really making it up as they were going along. And the Cybernetics Initiative was another attempt, the fourth or fifth, to make the system work more efficiently than it had. Another thing I really liked about the book, and this is really a subtext, is that the competition between capitalism and socialism was really one of it's interesting because it was a providing plenty. It was a providing abundance. That's what socialism promised people. They said, look, we're going to make you rich. That's what we're going to do.
That, it seems to me, is one of the things that we're in danger of losing sight of by reading backwards from the end of the Soviet Union and our kind of default picture of it as a place of obsolescent tractor factories.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's there. If you look back at Khrushchev and Nixon in the American kitchen in Moscow, having their kitchen debate, Khrushchev is entirely signed up to the idea that the test of communism will be its ability to outdo the West at this stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, he reserves the right to be a little bit sarcastic about some more elaborate labor-saving appliances, but basically it's better washing machines. Mm-hmm. Socialism will provide better washing machines than capitalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, as I say, they've tried various things before. Unfortunately, there aren't great novels like yours about them. For example, there was War Communism, and then later there was the NEP period, what's called the NEP period in the 1920s, and then the most famous of them is collectivization and this rapid industrialization, forced industrialization. And then, of course, the war intercedes. But the next big initiative, and this is the one your book is about, is the Cybernetics Initiative. Let me ask you this, since I think most people don't know. What is cybernetics? It's not a word that really falls off the tongue at this point, or trips off the tongue.
Except that the cyber prefix has kind of floated free of cybernetics and headed off to a whole new net-related life. Cybernetics is an American idea from the 1940s. Norbert Wiener, visionary engineer, named it after the Greek word for a steersman, a kuberneteki. And it is the science of controlled systems. It's where the idea of feedback was first thought of. It's essentially a universal grammar for understanding the control of systems with positive feedback loops and negative feedback loops. And it begins in America at the kind of the interesting visionary fringe of American engineering, and it is instantly frowned upon as bourgeois the late Stalin time in the Soviet Union, but then gets quietly picked up by a generation of Soviet scientists who are about to become influential and use their influence to get cybernetics made first legitimate and then virtually compulsory in the Soviet Union by the mid-1960s. Because what they see is a way of talking in universal system design terms about a whole raft of problems in the Soviet sciences. They see it as a non-ideological language, something which is properly rational, which is free of the loading of various ideological terms. So they love it. They think they've chanced onto something which is like the sort of the true language of science, the language spoken in scientific Eden, where the nouns correspond to the things. And it takes a while for the ironies involved here to start to come apart. But there is this kind of cybernetic dawn in the Soviet Union in the late 50s, early 60s, when it suddenly looks like the key to getting proper genetics back, when it's instrumental in economic reform proposals, when you've got a bunch of Red Army telecommunications engineers suggesting, hey, why don't we do one great big computer network of all computer networks which would talk to each other with some kind of uniform protocol? Who knows what kind of application that could produce? There's a great paper by Slava Gerovich of MIT called Internet about why that particular idea didn't reach the fruition. Mm-hmm. Could have done, because it's exactly parallel to the ARPANET. But I mean, if I can go back a bit, cybernetics is exactly in sequence of various Soviet panaceas. Basically, it is a sign of the way in which the Soviet Union was both an intensely developed society, extremely rich in maths and physics PhDs, and also in a funny way still a kind of anxious, intellectually deferential one, that it kept importing ideas, each of which was in turn seen as the one true solution, the key to turn all locks. You can say that Bolshevism, you know, in its way was in fact one of those ideas in itself, and war communism is partly modeled on what the Germans were doing with indicative planning during World War One. The NEP is a kind of capitalism light. And in a way, they don't really get original until they get to the first five-year plan. Although it's, you know, one could think of that as being a kind of Soviet daydream about Taylorist management. It's kind of time and motion study taken to its absolutely kind of logical extreme. Mm-hmm. East of the Ural, Stakhanovites are carrying out the Taylor management principle, but, and this is where eventually the cybernetics is going to come in a world where demand signals are almost non-existent. And that doesn't matter too much in the first heavy lifting stage of industrialization, because you know you need lots of producer goods. You need your concrete and you need your electricity and you need your steel to do everything else. And for a while, it makes sense to have metrics which are purely to do with output. More and more and more and more and more, please. And you can pat yourself philosophically on the back and say, we've escaped from the falsifications of Western thinking about this, because we are never held back by anything except the technical limitations of our society. And then it turns out, by this fascinatingly kind of sort of endogenous process, that entirely cut off pretty much from the mainstream of 20th century economics and 20th century social science, the mathematicians and physicists who are trying to sort these things out in the Soviet Union reason their way back to the necessity of something like price signals in order to set, you know, to set a relative agenda for what needs to be produced, how much, in what order, for where. And cybernetics then appeals to them because it looks as if it provides a technical alternative to markets. It'll give you a complete priority list, which will let you run your huge coordinated society, and all of those feedback loops will take care of the relative proportion of the parts. And there are genuinely brilliant people doing this. One of my central figures or characters, depending if it isn't, they're coming to that. One of my central figures, Leonid Vitalievich Kantorovich, the only Soviet citizen ever to win a Nobel Prize for economics, produces some genuinely groundbreaking maths, which becomes part of the basis for linear programming, gets used as an algorithm all over the world now in airline scheduling and Mexican cement delivery and loads of stuff, and spends the rest of his life trying to persuade the powers that be that if they would just reform the Soviet economy according to his prescription, then sweet reason and material abundance would follow quickly. And my book is a kind of investigation of the ironic failure of this vision, either to be tried or to deliver when it was tried.
I'm trying to think how to ask this question.
Oh, ask it rudely.
I was going to ask it rudely, but you know, the people who are working on this, these economists who are very quantitatively oriented, let's put it that way, how much of it did they see cybernetics as a cover for the introduction of market reforms, and how much did they see it as really an attempt to create a kind of socialist feedback network of information from demand?
This is an extremely tricky question, and I ended up, I thought, having to decide between two perfectly viable ways of understanding the same limited set of data, limited partly because I don't speak the Russian. One understanding of it would say these people are part of the kind of intellectual loyal opposition in Soviet life. They are people who, like almost everybody in Soviet intellectual life, are signed up to the basic legitimacy of their society and its project. So yes, they more or less buy the distant caricature of capitalism as hideous, destructive, anti-Semitic, prone to frequent crises, and yes, are interested in cybernetics as an alternative to that. They think they can genuinely outdo it. It's part of the old Stalinist slogan of overtaking and surpassing, only now being carried out in subtle, humane, intellectual terms rather than by forced labor, for example. Conversely, yes, these are extremely clever people. And if you did want to quietly reintroduce controversial ideas like supply and demand into your economy, if your idea of reason was fundamentally market-based, then you wouldn't do anything very different from what you tried to do. You'd be nibbling at the margin of the irrationality of the planned economy by trying to suggest ways in which a demand-like logic could be kind of, you know, could be sneaked into it. So competing with capitalism, sneaking capitalism in. On the one side, there is the kind of relative intellectual isolation of you know, Soviet mathematical life, and I would say signs of continuing lingering socialist idealism in these people. They have, you know, they have their hopes invested here. I think I very much liked Stephen Kotkin's description of the Soviet Union as a society booby-trapped with idealism. People are willing to be idealistic in kind of Bolshevik ways right to the end of Soviet history. Mm-hmm. Terribly destructive consequences. There are various moments in which they could have chosen the Chinese route, for example. Yeah. And instead of which they do the idealistic thing and destroy the party's monopoly on power, for example, very end. Looked at the other way, Kantorovich, for example, was in contact with a lingering bit of pre-revolutionary economics expertise in St. Petersburg. And he was noted for never being willing to spell out the social consequences of his maths. He would present it in terms that factory managers could use as a kind of fingers and thumbs and slide rules kind of calculation. Mm-hmm. But he would never do implications. He constantly tried to press the idea that it, you know, it was just technical. Mm-hmm. And certainly now, some of the people I talked to said, you know, brilliantly clever man. Obviously, he could never have believed all of that bullshit. He was doing the most he could. But that seems to me to be in danger of a different kind of post-Soviet backward glance. It's got the wisdom of the rearview mirror in it, mm-hmm. and I don't entirely buy it. But in the end, and this goes back to the question of genre and what kind of book it was I wrote, I ended up leaning towards idealism rather than secret market-based cynicism in my understanding here, because it enabled me to tell the wider story of crumbling Soviet idealism. I mean, I partly made a literary rather than historical decision. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, one of the ways in which Red Plenty really does behave like a novel rather than like an essay.
Mm-hmm. No, I see what you mean. Yeah, that is consistent with my historical judgment. The people that I met in the Soviet Union, I can't really call them true believers in the sense that they were fanatics, but their word for taking profit was spekulatsiya.
Yeah.
That's the only word they had.
I know.
And that's the way they thought of it.
If you read studies of the Blatt networks of favor trading and things, there in people's most illicit and unofficial behavior, you get the kind of reproduction of official morality, only moved over a bit, so that people it's okay to trade things like, you know, access to flats and tutoring for children and things. But once you get into things that come a bit closer to kind of the core of communist morality, all of a sudden they're back on their Puritan hind legs, and they really think that stuff shouldn't have anything to do with money. It's to do with, you know, friendship and being a good person.
Mm-hmm.
So now I don't see lingering market based perceptions here. I see brilliantly clever people thinking their way slowly towards the edges of the domain of possible thoughts in their society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's approach the question slowly of what kind of a book this is. Mm. Histories are about real people. Are there real people in your book?
Yes.
Okay, who are they?
Kantorovich himself, Khrushchev himself. Mm-hmm. Although my warrant for putting Khrushchev himself in is, of course, a literary one. I'm doing Khrushchev because Tolstoy thought it was okay to do Napoleon. And, and, you know, because Solzhenitsyn thought it was okay to do... not that I resemble Tolstoy or Solzhenitsyn in any other ways at all, but hey, there are precedents for this. And I have a variety of kind of incidental historical people. I've got a chapter about the Novocherkassk massacre, and the factory manager is the real factory manager who made the disastrous Marie Antoinette-like speech suggesting that people, if they couldn't afford meat, would feed their children on awful pasties. Mm-hmm. And like that. So I've got the most famous of the mathematicians and the politicians tend to be real. Kosygin is in there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have some completely fictional people, and I also have this more ambivalent group in the middle who are fictional characters standing in the lives of real people. So I have people who are, as it were, fictional counterparts to the Soviet economist Abel Aganbekian and the biologist Risa Berg.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, it was, you know, it was curious working out what it was that I felt like I could and couldn't permit myself to do there. Because it's not like you've got truth over here and fiction over here. What you've actually got are several different versions of truth telling, which overlap with each other and sometimes produce complicated and even unpleasant interference effects as well. I mean, you can tell yourself quite easily that you are committed to the historical record, yes, and you can also tell yourself that you are committed to, as it were, the emotional truth of fiction, where everyone knows that making stuff up is a legitimate way for us to understand kind of human situations. If you're trying to install one inside the other, or one kind of partly overlapping the other, then you get into uncanny and paradoxical territory. And my anxiety about the book, and naturally I have a literary anxiety and a historical anxiety. anxiety is that I've ended up falsifying things. Not so much in terms of actual facts, but in terms of proportions of facts and where I have chosen to look. Because I know when I have made a literary judgment about where the attention of the book is going to go. I know that I'm not a scholar in the sense that I want to find out everything that can be known and then decide from that what the narrative response should be. In some ways, my narrative response shapes where I went looking. So there's a historical anxiety there. And then on the other side, there's a literary anxiety, which says, what if my people are half alive? What if I'm operating in the uncanny valley here? Nice term from the video games development. Where your people are well enough animated to be really worrying. Where the fact that they're nearly human really starts to show. Mm-hmm. On the whole, I haven't had reactions that confirm either worry. Historians tend to think I've got it more or less right. Mm-hmm. Although with a little bit of kind of license for kind of, you know, pretty right for a literary guy.
Yeah.
Hey, I'll take that. And conversely, I've tended to get the literary judgment that it reads okay, although its kind of partitioning is very historical. Once something has built up some emotional steam, quite often it then kind of runs into an explanatory wall as I change the subject and start talking about the annual rhythm of the planning process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What I would like to be the case, don't know if it is that there is, you know, a kind of ad hoc definition of success to be had somewhere on this center ground between history and literature in which you could have a genuinely explanatory urge and carry it out with genuinely artistic means. This is me sunbathing and mm-hmm. drinking a drink with an umbrella in it and daydream, yes. You understand. Mm-hmm. My judgment on myself is rather more severe than that. that would be the happy ending. That would be literary abundance or historical mm-hmm. abundance for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are things that you include in the book of an anecdotal nature, which I think for people, Westerners especially, who have traveled to the Soviet Union, ring very true. And also are more or less impossible to get at using sort of standard historical documents. And one that I really appreciated, and I wonder how you actually got the idea to do it, is when the young mathematician goes and visits the parents of his girlfriend or betrothed right outside Moscow, in a village right outside Moscow. And for anybody who's visited the Soviet Union in the 1970s or 80s, you know, the difference between inside Moscow and right outside it is incredible.
Yeah.
You really, it's like you were going into the third world. And you do a really nice job of showing this, and his surprise. How did you come up with that particular anecdote?
Because I didn't have to invent it. That is a true story about Abel Agenbekian.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Which appears in one of his later perestroika-era memoirs. But it's a very bare anecdote, and this is part of the way in which I borrowed elements of his life and then made it happen to a fictional person. He went to visit his future in-laws in a village as, I think, very much the kind of urban, privileged, mm-hmm. privileged young member of the intelligentsia who I present. And he walked for miles and miles and miles and was appalled by what he found, because it squared so little with what mm-hmm. he understood to be the nature of his own society.
Yeah.
It seemed to me to be a beautiful measure of the gulf between Soviet reality and Soviet self-description. And I wanted it to be in there as a measure of how far they'd have to go to get to their own standards of success. And I wanted them to know it, though.
Yeah.
I didn't want them to seem simply blind from the beginning about the scale of the task. I wanted them to at least be able to frame the ambition required for that task. But I mean, starting there, I mean, you start with one anecdotal piece of truth, and then you expand in all directions by looking at the geography of the Moscow region and mm-hmm. by comparing pictures of nice flats in late Stalin Moscow with the kind of tumble down wooden stuff that peasants were living in 45 kilometers away, and you think about food and drink and clothes mm-hmm. and that stuff, and then I mean lots and lots of Soviet literature flows in here. In some ways, I mean, it's an intensely managerial society with unthinkingly kind of snobbish reactions to those who are who are less like Intman, it is part of its desire to be modern is this kind of completely unembarrassing kind of willingness to judge people as backward if they aren't. And there is a strand in Soviet literature which is just disgusted by Russians, mm-hmm. which is constantly going kind of, here is Ivan. Ivan is illiterate and dirty. He has a beard, ladies and gentlemen, and eats revolting things. Whereas, if Ivan lived in Moscow and had a higher degree, right. he could be eating at this, gastronome number one, ladies uh-huh. and gentlemen. And in the evenings, he could read Tolstoy or perhaps go to the ballet. We should all be like that shouldn't
yeah,
we?
No. Yep. No, that's definitely there. You know, you mentioned this word, this expression, Soviet reality. I don't know if you encountered it when you were there, but it's a kind of a cliche. It's an ironic cliche, Sovietskaya действительность, and yep. Russians use it or used it when they were confronted with this yawning gap between the way things were supposed to be and yep. the way things are. So they, you know, you would see something like, I remember. I have all these anecdotes. I remember seeing like just the corpse of a dog, just like practically in the middle of the street in front of my building, and just like stayed there all. And I'm just like, I told my friend, you know, I said, look, buddy, look at that. And he said, well, that's Sovietskaya действительность right there. And they had an expression for it. They knew exactly what it was. And yeah, and it's an interesting thing. Let me ask about another.
Let me interrupt for a moment. In some ways, I mean, that level of slightly chaotic Soviet reality just stays constant all the way through. And what changes is that people's willingness to overlook it or to reinterpret it optimistically yeah. is what gradually goes away. Sheila Fitzpatrick has got some very nice writing here about the ability of educated Soviet opinion to systematically ignore stuff like yeah. that. Early on in the Khrushchev time, which gradually wore away, to that the precedence that the radiant future originally had over kind of boring dead dog reality yeah. kind of gradually like a sort of circus tent with the air being let out of it.
Yeah, I remember seeing these posters in which it was a graph and it showed the price of furniture. I remember it was furniture, mebel. And it started as, you know, costing this amount, and then it went down and down and down and down until it said free. Wow. Furniture was free. And this was yeah. in 1972. I was there in 1984. And I'm like, wait a minute, it's not free yet. And they're like, say it's got a seasonal list. You know, it's just not free yet. Huh. And but, you know, again, you point out something.
It's asymptotically approaching the condition
yeah.
of being free. That's yeah. I mean, once the graph finally crosses the axis, yeah. then paradise is accomplished.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. But, you know, my very simplistic theory of the failure of the Soviet Union has a lot to do with the fact that they didn't do what they said they were going to do. They yeah. said they were going to make people rich, and they yeah. didn't make people rich. That's the deal. And people yeah. knew it. And, you know, sure, they wanted to believe, and they kept believing. There are lots of things that I believe in that are completely quixotic that probably will never happen. But, you know, after a while, you become cynical about it, and your trust gets eroded away in the people that are telling you that it's going to be just over the next hill. It's always just over the next hill. The Soviet Union lived in the future. It didn't live in the yeah. present, and this got to wear on people. I think they just didn't buy it anymore after a while. And that anecdote about going off into the countryside right outside Moscow is truly very, very telling. And another scene that I wanted to talk to you about, because I found it so remarkably compelling and also explanatory, is precisely the wandering in of one of the characters into the Gosplan. They call it a kartoteka in Russian. It's a big system of card files.
Yeah.
So it goes, and they had a word for it, orgtechnika. Orgtechnika. And they have these stores called Orgtechnika. And so it's organizational technology. And so how did you, I didn't know there was such a room, and how did you get that?
This is where I have to reveal the terrible shortcuts I took here. I read a description in conceptual terms of the commodity file system, and then I worked backwards from what the files had to have in them yeah. in order to accomplish what year by year they kind of managed to do.
Right.
Fitted it together with general descriptions of Soviet organizational technology and. Uh-huh. and this life, and I'm afraid deduced the existence, the necessary existence of a room in Gosplan that behaved like that. Here I have to hold my hands up and go, the room itself is fictional, but the role that it played is not fictional. So just as I supplied my prototype, intelligent, subtle, cynical Gosplan high up with an East German office chair with casters so that he could zoom upwards across the
room. That's good.
And it's true that there was an East German office.
Would have been East German, yeah, that's clear.
Yeah, naturally, because they were still feeding in kind of vaguely Bauhausy office furniture into the whole of the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah.
No, it's conceptually right and it's circumstantially right, but I have no evidence of an actual room in Gosplan like that.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I'm a guy sitting in a research library in the West who doesn't speak Russian. I hold my hands up.
Yeah, no, but it's an interesting idea, and it's certainly, I believe it's correct. If somebody knows out there whether there were such rooms full of kartotieki, please contact me, because it's a great image, and it shows how hard what they were trying to do was, because all the information in that card catalog was opaque.
Hmm.
I mean, it was all in those cards. You can't see in those cards. It's not like you could just search them and say, okay, I want all the steel production in the eastern part of the country in the following oblast for the following years. You know, there's no Google search here. It's all buried. And and the person who is most powerful remembers most of it.
Exactly.
And they just, you can't remember that much stuff.
Confirmation right at the top of the planning system of the weird way in which in a non-market economy, everything is much more personal, where there is no genuinely impersonal exchange through the price system. People knowing things becomes absolutely, absolutely critical for anything to happen. Part of the enthusiasm about computerization among the scientists I've written about is because they liked the idea of being able to search by pig iron or search by oblast. They never actually got there because that would have meant erasing all of the minor strongholds of bureaucratic knowledge which possessed their bit and knew in the existing system how in fact their knowledge could be put to work in bureaucratic terms. So I mean that chapter of the book has got a kind of zoom downwards through the layers of the Soviet economy, down from Gosplan through plant management, finally down to the not quite black market but illicit deal making at the bottom required to make the wheels turn. And every layer is opaque to the other layers there. Nobody knows what the next people down are really doing, and all they have to go on is highly unreliable numbers and their beady-eyed judgment of the human reality of what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you have another character in the book, and I've met a couple of people like this. I call them fixers in the West, but they're farsovshiki, I think is what it is in Russian. And they're people that had some sort of local knowledge that they could use to make deals. It's quite like a commodity trader in the United States who knows how to make a deal. Like, I know where I can actually get these filters. I can get them at this price. You don't know that. I'll sell that information to you, and I'll take a cut of the deal. That's very common in capitalism. Happens all the time.
Absolutely.
Now, there are all kinds of people trying to work their way around that, and the Internet is great for it. So you can cut the middlemen out. I mean, these are middlemen, but in the Soviet system, there were middlemen everywhere because there had to be middlemen everywhere because they don't. That's the only way the information could pass.
But with some interestingly inverted roles, so that whereas in capitalism the sales role is the vital persuading point in the economy, here they are professional buyers. They are ones who know how to extract the goods from producers who see no particular reason for parting to them to any particular customer. It is all middlemen, in a way, but
it is
never quite reconciled to the existence of middlemen either.
Yeah.
Every now and again, there are tightening campaigns in which they try and winkle these people out. And it would have been disastrous if they'd ever managed it, because the middlemen are the people who are knowledge brokers, the ones who move between isolated pools of information.
That's exactly right. And the great thing, I don't know if it's great, but one of the characteristics of capitalism is that there's just a systematic tendency to cut these people out as often as possible. get rid of them and lower the price and sell into the market. I mean, I've seen it dozens and dozens of times of middlemen that are just basically cut. You know, there used to be bookstores and there used to be record shops. Those middlemen got cut out. You know, they knew the records, they knew the books. Those people, unfortunately or unfortunately, I don't know, are gone. But in this system, it's impossible to cut these people out because they have all that local knowledge, which you need actually to make the system run even at a very minimal level of efficiency.
Though also, I mean, the whole book could be called Perverse Incentives in some ways. I don't, in fact, think that makes sense as a complete description of how Soviet reality works. But undeniably, at every level, there are perverse incentives going on there, because what you get is a setup where the various middlemen, people try to turn themselves into middlemen and to be as uncooperative as possible in order to maximize the value of their particular bit of knowledge. I mean, including, you know, which of the public payphones is genuinely out of service? Well, do a favor to the lady behind the counter and she will point to you at the one which will actually work if you put your 5 kopeck piece in. Is the kitchen really closed does the waiter want something from you? Right. There is an immense transaction costs applied to everything. Immense friction.
Friction is exactly the word. Yeah, this is friction, and it occurs in capitalism as well, especially in markets that can be monopolized. I'm reminded of, as part of the New Books Network, I buy a lot of domain names, and there are companies that just have bought them up willy nilly, and they're just friction. I mean, they're just holding them off the market so that they can gouge me. Gouge. I don't know. I mean, they bought them. Whatever. You know. Yeah. It's actually required me to do some clever things to eliminate that middleman. In the Soviet system, it was much more difficult. There's another scene in the book which I thought was a terrific evocation of the reality of the way the Soviet system worked, and that is where it is explained to someone, I can't remember who, how money just doesn't really make any difference. Money is not the universal store of value, and it's not a currency. It just is. It isn't that important in the system. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, money is necessary but never sufficient to make anything happen. Money is tokens, it's vouchers, it's the thing which, when you have done the deal for some other reason, will then inevitably change hands so that there can be a kind of bookkeeping reconciliation about it. But money is never the motive for action. It's never the true store of value. Because of the fundamental nature of the society and constantly reinforced decision making about this, had money been able to be active, all sorts of things would no longer have been within the powers of conscious choice of politicians at the top of the system, of bureaucrats midway down, but also of lots and lots of private individuals. In some ways, This is a society that shares the idea that people should do things for human reasons. Treat me as a human being, a very right. Soviet statement, which actually means everything should be pragmatic. Everything should be negotiated between the two of us. So we say bureaucracy, but oddly, Soviet bureaucracy is very unlike the traditional kind of Weberian definition of what bureaucracy it is. It isn't this impersonal, rule-governed structure. It's a mass of people in offices, all of whom have to be negotiated with separately. It's weirdly unstreamlined. It's more like a kind of coral reef or something. I'm sorry. I don't know what the question is. I'm just heading off.
No, that's okay. I'm reminded a little bit of something you occasionally see in movies, and that is when the mafia boss says to the person he's about to kill, it's not personal, it's just business.
Yeah.
But you know that's BS. Because everything is personal in the mafia. There can't be anything that isn't personal in the mafia.
That's why, in fact, the same guy, Chekhuskin, my fictional fixer, says everything is personal a lot, because it seems to me to be the central Soviet truth. He comes up next to a chapter called Prisoner's Dilemma, because one of the things I wanted to be a little ironic about is our over-readiness in the West to think that, you know, that the Prisoner's Dilemma in game theory is this, you know, this sad thing about about how cooperation is ruled out by the structure of the game, and if we could manage to trust each other in our separate cells, kind of greater goodwill and benevolence would occur. But in fact, the classic way of outwitting the prisoner's dilemma is to be in the mafia. If you have got a genuine, convinced kind of gun-enforced ability to provide people with stronger reasons to be loyal to each other, then you can outwit the prisoner's dilemma, because you can never get a grand jury to convict you. And it seemed to me that everything is personal has very similar effects here. There is an extremely untouchy-feely area of human cooperation that becomes necessary when everything is personal. I mean, mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk slightly satirical terms, really, about what happens in a society in which you never get to turn your personal radar off, in which all your human relationships are partly infused with the material conduct of your whole society. So you are constantly having to mix personal life with economic life. And I wanted the kind of the horribleness of that to come out, and the way that it made everyone a kind of low-level mafioso in some ways.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit like a family. You know, you can never really, I don't know, I'm cynical about families, but in the family, decisions are not made usually on economic bases. I mean, you got to get somebody's assent or will, or there's anger and fear and these other things, and imagine that writ large. You know, it is in a certain way kind of terrifying. And in the Russian context, there are words and concepts which are indicative of this. Every Russian of any import had what was called a krishka, a roof, and that was their protector. That was somebody, it was their patron, basically. Somebody, you know, sort of 18th century English sort of thing, like, you know, he has a letter of recommendation from that guy. Mm-hmm. And so he's untouchable. He's a made man. You know, there he is. And the only disruption that can come is from way up. And it can't come from within the system, because everybody has this very subtle kind of accounting of favor trading. And you know, blot is something else that you mentioned, and that just means influence, but it's influence beyond anything we can really understand. It's a kind of fungible influence. It can really get you stuff. It's not I can convince him to go, you know, to the country for the weekend. It's not like that. I can actually get gas there.
It's not marginal. It is actually overlying what we think of as the cash economy to a huge extent. What you were saying, I was just remembering Nadezhda Mandelstam, the poet's wife, writes somewhere about finding herself, I think in a bath, in a bathhouse or something, with Madame Yagoda, the security chief's wife, sometime in the 30s, because one of the oddities of the, you know, Soviet cultural politics is that cultural people, as well as being oppressed, also have extraordinary high-level access. And Madame Yagoda says to her, kind of comfortably and familiarly, "Tell me, who do you go to?" Meaning exactly that. Which Politburo member has, you know, everyone's got a string of posts. Who do you belong to?
Uh-huh. It's quite true. So let me ask you this: how did it fall apart? Let's just conclude by you know, sort of like it didn't work, right? I should tell you, by the way of an anecdote. I've been to a
multiple reasons. In some ways, I'm trying not to abuse my license to be literary here, but its collapse is so overdetermined that in some ways, picking the relative effect of different factors is very difficult. But here are some. Whereas the first stage of an industrial revolution can be done without demand signals, it's very difficult to move on to the subtler stuff. The coordination problems get much worse as you move up the value tree. And whereas the Soviet Union could do 1930s capitalism simulated rather well, they couldn't move from heavy industry to light industry. They couldn't really substitute kind of end user definitions of what was valuable. That's one thing. That's an underlying thing. The reform proposals would probably have been destructive rather than helpful. And in some ways, small C Soviet conservatives, like, and I show Kosygin kind of putting his thumb down firmly to prevent the 1965 reform from getting too cybernetic. They were probably quite acute in saying that actually it would simply have made the economy work less coherently than it already did. The decay of various kinds of idealism has something to do with it, and with it the willingness to do political risk taking. In some ways, Khrushchev, extremely rash as a leader that he was, is the last Soviet leader till Gorbachev who was willing to take risks in order to get results. So there's a small C conservatism sinking down into kind of, you know, we're glad of what we've got, we'll stay with that. Oil, which provides starting in the 60s, oil revenue seems to provide a kind of gloriously straightforward alternative to all of this complicated coordinated development stuff, because you can just sell oil to the capitalists and spend the money on importing salamis and fiat and other stuff. So that in the 1970s, the superpower USSR is partly just, it's buying its aircraft carriers with oil, and it's buying its salamis and fiats for its people with oil as well. And that's a lot more straightforward. Commodity production, which is what contemporary Russia seems to have ended up with, is much, much simpler to do. And then there is a political thing here about the defeat of a generation's political hopes and political project. The people who were in their 20s and early 30s in the 1960s, who had been expecting to rise into positions of influence, had to wait for 20 years. And Gorbachev's generation in the 1980s are those people. His economic advisors are the disappointed graduate students of the early 1960s who finally get to carry out their generational project of socialism with a human face through, you know, cybernetic economics and things. And a lot of what, you know, the kind of that incredibly rapid shuffle of of non-functional reform proposals from 1985 through to sort of 88 or 89 or so are versions of 1960s ideas. Mm-hmm. And they don't work, but they are being pursued with genuine commitment, which is why they don't seem to have gone the Chinese route. I mean, right. It's the great mystery.
Yep.
The Soviet Union could be standing now. All they had to do was decollectivize land and bin the planning system and keep the Leninist political system. That's what the Chinese did. There'd be far more skyscrapers in Russia now than just the Gazprom Tower. if they'd done that. And the only reason that I think makes sense is the idealism that trapped the system. A last lingering desire to vindicate Bolshevism in its own terms rather than being pragmatic.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're exactly right. Let me ask one more question. What happened to your characters? What happened to cybernetics and the characters that sort of pushed it, and
cybernetics,
Berg and these other people?
Okay. Kantorovich becomes a much-loved grand old man of Soviet mathematics with graduate students and graduate students of graduate students who form a kind of tribe in his honor, who love and revere him for the beauty of his mind and his innocence. And he dies in 86, I think, mm-hmm. before he can be disappointed by perestroika. Mm-hmm. Abel Agenbekian, who's not one of my characters, but whose life I borrowed slightly, becomes a Gorbachev advisor, and then does his damnedest to make things work between 1985 and 1990, and then adapts rather well and kind of, you know, in quick footedly to the new capitalist reality and founds an investment bank. Khrushchev gets sacked by his colleagues and dies in sorrow and nightmares and guilt, gardening in his dacha, but posing for photographs with Soviet holidaymakers who walk past his place. He being one of the few Soviet leaders who it was safe to ask, you know, to pose for a photograph with you. And I find him wonderful as a figure because, monster though he was, he remains a kind of recognizable human being, mm-hmm. With a a kind of dented and blackened but still functional soul. And he dies talking bitterly and in a state of terrible bemusement and bafflement about why socialism doesn't seem to be what he was told it was. He says into the tape recorder his son provides, paradise is a place that people are supposed to want to be, not a place that they flee from.
Yeah.
What kind of socialism is it when you have to keep people in chains? What kind of shit is this? He says, being as foul-mouthed as he ever was when he was in the Politburo.
Yeah.
And I say goodbye to the rest of them, to the fictional ones, at various points in the kind of late 60s, early 70s, when they're making their peace with Brezhnevite reality. Poor Lebedev, the Soviet computer pioneer, dies of lung cancer while fruitlessly trying to persuade Kosygin that they really ought not to give up indigenous computer design and just imitate IBM.
Mm-hmm.
But the Politburo, like various other corporate types in the 1970s, took the view that nobody was ever fired for buying IBM. In their case, reverse engineering. That's a sad. It is a sad end altogether. Yeah. If you assume that the idealism provides the plot.
Yeah. No, I see what you mean. Let me ask another question before I ask our final question. I know I'm dragging this out a little bit, but we promised we would talk about it, and I think we can spar a little bit. I would say this is a book of historical fiction. I don't think you would, and many reviewers didn't.
I think it's genuinely both. That's the thing. I think the mixture is too real for it to settle down in being one thing. It's shaped like an explanation. And though I've got a whole I can say about how you know, why should fiction always be concerned with private lives? We neglect work in the novel. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah. This is all true. In some ways, I'm not following a completely imaginative thread through. The structure is given by explanation, which is a historical thing to do.
Yeah.
If it were a historical novel, then at some point I would be running with the shape of those lives rather than stopping and going, but over here in another part of the forest.
Right. War and Peace style.
Yeah.
Yeah. War and Peace style.
That is a novel, come to think of it.
Yeah, War and Peace is a novel. Yeah, he claimed it wasn't a novel.
Ah, you see?
He said, this is not a novel. This is something else. Yeah.
Another of the very few ways in which I resemble Paul.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, there have been a lot of comparisons to Orwell. That's not a bad thing.
Oh, God, no. No, I am very flattered by comparisons like that.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up with a kind of Orwell-soaked understanding of the world. I read 1984 when I was 11, for example.
Yeah.
So you know, it stains my vision of everything. So,
mm-hmm. And you know, with the sales of this book, you'll never have to work again. Isn't that nice?
I don't know how to break this, to you, Marshall. But,
you mean you didn't make a huge pile of cash?
No, but then you know, I'm skeptical about money. What's really important?
Yeah, no, it's true. Money. It's true. Well, this has been one of my most enjoyable interviews. As I said, I became a fan of the book early on. I'm not the kind of person to generally do that, but I read it and I said, you know what? This guy's on to something, and I got to get in touch with him. So it's really a terrific book. It's called Red Plenty. And, you know, sometimes it has a subtitle and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. It had a subtitle in England, partly because the publisher was nervous and thought people needed a little bit of a little bit of steering to show them what kind of thing it was, and the subtitle has vanished in the US edition, and I'm quite glad. I'd rather people made up their own mind about whether it was a novel or history or something else.
I included the subtitle though. I think I mentioned the subtitle. I don't know. It doesn't really matter very much. But anyway, Francis, thank you so much for talking with us today. Again, the book is called Red Plenty. I encourage you to go out and buy it so Francis never has to work again, although he'll work again anyway, because that's the way people like us work.
Yeah.
And I hope you have a good day.
Thank you, Marshall.
Okay, take care. You've been listening to an interview with Francis Bufford about his new book, Red Plenty, Industry, Progress, Abundance, Inside the 50s Soviet Dream. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.